now basically we would look at certain aspects of the different architectures, and the focus is what type of system models we have. System models in the sense of architectural model, the failure model, but also the interaction module model, which takes place to distinguish various aspects. And the other thing is we will look at transparency, something like as a key concept of distributed applications or distributed systems. And then we can look at various models, how the distributed components basically cooperate as well as interact with each other. And as part of it, as an example, we look at the client-server model as well as situations when errors or failures take place, how the client can react, how the server can react on it. The various models we can look at are these architectural model, interaction model, failure model, and the security model. With this model, you somewhat provide something like a description of the relevant aspects. So here, descriptive model for relevant aspects, and in some sense you would get something like an abstract or simplified view of it. Just with the architectural model, you more or less look at the components which belong to the distributed application, as well as then the interaction between these components, how they basically belong together, and how they interact with each. That's we then look then later in the interaction model. If we look at the architectural model, the important aspect what we have here is what are our major piece of entity. And major piece of entities are on one hand processes, and the other thing is are objects the processes operate on. And therefore in that sense we can build it somewhere around of these two types of entities. And if we look at the software layers we have available, then we can say, well, on the lowest level we have the hardware, then the operating system, the communication middleware, and then the application and the services. This one here, the lower two levels, usually they are called the platform. And the middleware provides something like programming abstractions on one hand to mask the heterogeneity of the lower level, like the operating system and the network, as well as to hide complexity. And that's what I have here, to hide the complexity. I mean here, in a sense, what kind of protocol do you have? What kind of restrictions do you have with respect to the messages which can be sent back and forth between the participating partners? The heterogeneous environment refers to the computers and the operating systems used. Do you use macOS, Linux? Do you use regular Unix or Windows environments? On the other hand, it also masks what type of network you have. And do you use Ethernet? Do you use wireless LAN? And so on. to hide that type of things, but it could also hide the heterogeneous data. What kind of data representations do you have here? For example, strings. As I mentioned already before, if you have C programming, strings are basically terminated by a null character at the end, and everything before belongs to the string. If you have other representations, very often you find something like the first part of a string. It's basically the length of the string, and then comes the string. And there might be a null character at the end. There might be not, because the length of the string is determined by the length part of the string. And in that sense, the point is here that you have a number of heterogeneous situations. Categories you have with respect to middleware, you can look at distributed objects, and that's more like in the sense of Java, RMI, as well as Corba. These are examples of distributed objects. If you look at distributed components, that's more like what we already talked about. Enterprise Java Beans is an example of it. Publish and subscribe. Here you can use here the Corba event service, but also that's one of the things what Google uses to use this publish and subscribes metaphor. Web services, here that would be an example, would be Apache Access or peer-to-peer, and here there are a number of systems available, but also an example is Nutella, which provides a peer-to-peer service environment. Other, more on a component model level, is DCOM, and .NET is more towards what you have with Java RMI, like distributed objects. The middleware services here, what belongs to it? First of all, communication facilities, like sending a message from one component to another component. And important with it is here the naming. Therefore, the middleware might support to resolve names to the appropriate receiving object or receiving component. For that, the middleware might interact with a directory service. But the middleware basically, in a lot of support environments, uses just or takes just the name, and then it tries to find a way to resolve the name to the appropriate IP address and port. But it's not really part of the application layer. It's something what the middleware provides as a service. Often you find also persistent support for data, and also for some environments, distributed transactions. For example, Corba provides transaction facilities. There you can bundle multiple service requests and service answer to a transaction. And you get the typical transaction behavior. Either all requests are successful, or if one request fails, then basically all the other requests are failing. Therefore, you have this all or nothing behavior, but not something like one part of the requests are successful, part of the other requests are not successful. Therefore, this atomic all or nothing behavior. And that's a support by the Corba middleware. you decide here, now I want to have a transaction, and then you put all the requests under the transaction service, and then you automatically get that behavior. And you as an application programmer, you don't really have to handle it yourself. It's more like you outsource it to the middleware. And here, similar things. You get here security, and here an important part would be our authentication. Like the application would not really check and authenticate the server. That should be done by the middleware to certify, is that the correct server we are interacting with, or is it not? And there you already see that if you outsource a lot of these things into the middleware, then application programming becomes a lot easier, because you move a lot of these standard things away into the middleware layer. And well, no, that's we can come then later to it. The next aspect with software architectures. Here we look at different types of architectural paradigms. The most often used paradigm is that of the client-server. If you look at web interaction or web services, typically you have a client-server behavior. A client requests something. You have a server basically accepting requests or rejecting requests. If it accepts it, then it performs the request and then sends the result back. And usually that's done synchronously. Therefore, in that sense, the client waits until it gets the request answered. If you do that on a thread level, it make it the application might still continue to work if only one thread of the client would be blocked. And therefore, in that sense, you still have a lot of parallel execution and synchronous interaction between client and server makes life a lot easier for the programmer, as we will see later on. The proxy servers, I mean, here you have something like shared resources, and an important part is here this caching. And that allows, for example, if you look at web proxies, here one web client makes an request, an URL request. The proxy basically caches that information. If another client comes to the same using the same resource, then the answer, it's you only what has to be checked if the information in the cache is still valid. If it's valid, you don't have to transfer it again. You can basically just use it out from the proxy server. And in that sense, you can say, well, increase performance. And that's basically the point of a proxy server as well as of a cache. The other things you can have even increase availability. If the information is in the cache and the network is not really up and running, the system might just reuse the information which is available in the cache, even if it doesn't know it's up to date or not. And that's sometimes irritating for the user, that the system takes information out of the cache presents the web page, you think, well, didn't we modify the web page from another system a few minutes ago? And you still get the old data. And therefore, in that sense, you have to enforce that there is a check between the cached information and remote information if it's still valid. Peer processes, it's something similar as client-server. Only we can say all processes play the same role. So here, all processes play the same role. That means they play the role of a client and they play the role of a server. And that's not the case in the client-server model. You have always specific roles for the processes. And that's different from peer processes. And therefore, that's exactly what you do with these document sharing on a peer level or music sharing with on a peer level. It's basically everyone has certain parts of or certain pieces of music stored on his or her disk, and if somebody searches an audio file, then if you have it available, you would provide it in as a server. On the other hand, if you are searching for an audio file which is provided by somebody else, you would then act as a client looking for it. And we will see two types of implementation of the peer paradigm. There are some implementations which still have something like a centralized component, and the centralized component knows where to find information. And then there exists also a completely decentralized approach where you don't have a central component anymore. Basically, you have to search who knows where to find the relevant information you are looking for. And that would mean something like a multicast to a certain number of peer processes. Like, do you know where the audio file is located? If they don't answer, then they might propagate it to a subsequent request to their friends. And at the end, you would get the answer, oh yeah, this peer process knows or has the audio file, and then you can contact that peer process to copy it. And the last thing is also from the implementation is something like a community of software agents. And there exists this FIPA approach. Does anybody know that or heard of it? And it's something like physical. P stands for physical agents, foundation, and now I don't remember the I anymore. The point is the following: it's a standardization with respect to software agents. People of you who were in artificial intelligence courses, they often talk about agents, like agents which can behave like humans, behavioral agents and things like that. There, the intention is more towards intelligence and intelligent agents. Here, with software agents, it's something like autonomy. That means these agents have something like their own state. They can decide on their own. And additionally, what comes to it is they can proactively act. And if you look at client server, here you have the client acting and the server reacting with respect to a request. And that's somewhat different, because here with software agents, they can act on some requests in a reactive level, but they could also proactively do certain things. And therefore, in that sense, they need some kind of intelligence where they can decide if they proactively should do something or not. What's also in this FIPA standard decided, they have something like an agent communication language. It's something like a standard how these software agents interact with each other. Usually with a client-server model, it always means, well, we'll look at our protocol, and then the client and server are basically matched up towards the protocol. Here, you have something like a standard language, like Esperanto. In that sense, every agent is supposed to understand that and handle according to that. Therefore, you have the possibility of new agents coming into the system, and if they speak the agent communication language, then they can basically interact with all the other agents. And in that sense, what you get is something like autonomous cooperating agents. And the intent is that we talk about not artificial intelligent agents, it's more like software agents. And these software agents can be programmed in Java, they can be programmed in an artificial intelligent language, or they can be programmed in C#, whatever you want to use. These are the four major models. And the major things what you find is client-server, somewhat, especially in the web environment, with proxies, and then also with peer environments, but a lot less implementations of it. But they generate a lot of traffic on the network. I mean, they are not so so widely spread with respect to the implementation, but with respect to the internet traffic, they generate a lot of internet traffic. The next thing is with the interaction model. Here we look at the communication between the components. In the architectural model, we talked about, well, what kind of components we have and how they are distributed in the network. Here we look we look more with respect to the performance when exchanging messages, and also we look at something like setting time limits. And because if you have a client here and a server here, this one sends a message, a request, and as I mentioned before, we have synchronous behavior. Therefore, this client is basically waiting, or at least let's say the threat issuing the request is waiting until it gets the answer or the response back. The problem is, if this one does not react, then this one waits forever. Therefore, what we want to do is setting time limits. But on the other hand, here we have a network in between. If we set the time limit too narrow, then we might get a lot of timeouts here, because that delay in the network is just too large. And in that sense, we need something like a flexibility approach. If we have a lot of traffic, we might set the time limit wider or larger. If we have less traffic, then we might have it set it narrower, because then we get a quicker response to problems on the server side. And also on the server side, there might be also the problem with respect to how many requests come, how good is the server in handling all the requests. That's one of the points of it. The other thing is usually it's very difficult to maintain a single global time. We will check about certain approaches with respect to physical clocks. And there are these time servers, and we look at the network time protocol, basically how machines can synchronize each other with respect to the time. And for certain things, it might not be necessary to have a synchronized time. It might be completely sufficient to have logical clocks. And logical clocks provide you something like event ordering. They don't synchronize the clock. They only provide you event ordering and say, these two events are in order. Event one is before event two. And event one before event two is not only the case on machine one, but it's all on all other machines involved in the distributed application. The other thing is, with respect to, and that's what I have here, the consistent ordering, that's you usually achieve with logical clocks. And why is it necessary? That's, for example, if you have a number of operations on different machines, if you change the order at the end, if all the operations are executed, you might have a different state if you change the order. And that's exactly or especially important if you say here, this machine executes part of my distributed application, and this machine executes the same part of my distributed application because it's something like a backup. And let's say a hot backup. And it means every operation which is done here is also done here. And if this one machine is in trouble, this machine can basically take over immediately on the fly and continue to service requests. But that means the state here and the state here, they always have to be identical. And therefore, you can't really have the situation that here you have the order event one, or let's say operation one, then operation two, and here operation two, and then operation one. And that could mean the state here is then slightly different than the state here. Could be that even if you change the order, the state is identical. It really depends on the type of operation. And you just have to think of a simple thing. You have a variable here with this one, writes 10 in it. This one just overwrites it and puts 5 in it. Here you have the same variable. First you write 5 in it, and then you write 10 in it. Let's say the same variable. Then you write 10 in it. Well, if you take the state here, on one hand you have 5 in it, and here you have 10 in it. Therefore, the state is different. I'm looking at a cluster on the server side. And cluster, for example, that you have multiple servers, and one server is basically a hot backup. It's a fail-safe cluster in that sense. That's an example where the consistent ordering is important. And, for example, telephone switching systems do that. And they can handle actually the situation that you are in a call with a friend, and then the one switching computer basically fails, then the other one continues on, and you could continue on with your call. And it's not something like you get an interruption and then you're thrown out of the net of the telephone call and then you redial. It's basically an on the fly that your call can continue. You might have a slight delay, but it's a very slight delay, and that's the importance here, that hot backup or hot redundancy means that it can immediately take over. And it's not means, well, I can restart it, copy the state from somewhere, and reinitialize it. There we would talk about minutes to get it started. Here we talk about milliseconds to do that. Okay. The do not arrive at the same order. Well, I mean, here messages you can use, for example, multicasting, you can use broadcasting, or you can use unicasting to send messages, especially if we have a cluster of fail-safe machines. Usually what you do is you don't really send individual messages, you use multicasting as a message. And depending on the network delay, that could be that they arrive in different order. Good, that's the interaction model, failure model. Here, the point is here, situation that on one hand, certainly you have failures of processes, as you know from a regular programming, that if you program your software incorrectly, you might get a core dump or a crash, but that's basically located on in the local process where you have failures. But additionally, you get failures of communication channels. A typical example is you go through all these routers, a router gets too much traffic, then the router can decide to look at the priorities, which are basically marked on the TCP or on let's say IP level, looks at the priorities, low priority IP packets, it basically, or messages, it throws away. Therefore, you have something like a leaky bucket, then the things which are less important are thrown away and leak through the bucket. The more important are continued to send to the receiving receiving processes. Therefore, in that sense, we can lose messages. We can also have transmission problems in a sense that they are not correctly transmitted. In a sense like bit failures. And then our CRC check goes wrong and therefore the receiving machine throws away the message because it says there is an error in it and it can't correct it. And now we can look at different types of failures which have to be acknowledged or handled in a distributed environment. Certainly, we have crash faults. And here, the server or client can stop due to hardware or software failures. And we can say, nothing wrong is done. Therefore, in that sense, it doesn't do anything wrong. It just fails. Well, it can have consequences. For example, you remember even on your local operating system, if the operating system tries to write on your hard disk in your file system, if it crashes at the wrong time, it might destroy your directory index, and if you try later to access it, it asks you, well, do you want to format your hard disk? And then you have to see how to get into it. Therefore, crash can have some major influences, but it does not do actively something wrong. It just crashes possibly at the wrong time. The problem is, how can you detect it? For example, if the client sends a request to the server does not answer. It can't really decide if the message was lost or if the server crashed. Therefore, in that sense, in order to decide if the server process crashed, it would need redundant information. Otherwise, it can't really decide that. Here, for the detection of crash faults, you need redundant information. Message loss, that's I already mentioned before. If you have buffer overflow or from the router or network congestion, messages can also be lost. Well, the same situation here. In order to detect it, you need redundant information. And here, the redundant information means you might have an alternative path to the server process. And then you can use this alternative path to contact the server process. If it answers correctly, then you know, okay, there is something wrong with the first path. There might be some message losses. Then fail stop failures. Here, the process fails by crashing, but it not just simply stops, it still has enough time to that the system can notify the partners. And it's something similar as you know with what you have in the high performance computing center with the power outages, that it has a huge number of batteries, and if a power outage comes, it has something like a few minutes or a few, I don't know exactly, or 30 seconds or something. I mean, a certain time interval that it has time to do certain things, to basically have something like a consolidated shutdown of its system. Here you could say, well, the process fails, but the system is able to notice that and notify the relevant partners. Here, it gets a notification that the process failed, and in that sense, it overcomes the uncertainty: did the process crash, or did I have a message loss? And but it has a lot more complex support system. What you need, for example, in the operating system. Timing failures. Here, you might have to the bounds for timeouts might be too narrow, or a local clock exceeds the boundaries. Therefore, in that sense, you have the drift rate of your physical clock. And you don't really use time synchronization often enough, then the clock might drift away and drift away. It's a similar thing like with a wristwatch. And arbitrary failure, we can decide here two types. One is a non-malicious and one is a malicious one. Non-malicious Byzantine failure. These are very often something like, temporary failures. And they might occur if you have an overheating of your hardware. And therefore, your hardware might have some failures due to heat problems. And then it would not be something like a permanent crash. It would just have a small failure, writing the wrong data or omitting certain processing steps, and then it continues operating. And that's what I mean with these temporary failures. They are often very difficult to find, because then if you try a debugging and let the system run, you shut down all the other processes which you don't want to get distracted from all the other processes during your debugging. But it means that possibly your system is not as much under load, and therefore in that sense you don't get this heat problem. Everything works fine, you don't have any temporary problems, and it continues to work. It's therefore, in that sense, these arbitrary failures are very difficult to identify. The malicious Byzantine failures, these are something like the worst type of scenario. Here you have an attacker which basically tries to break your system, like corruption of messages, replay of messages, modifying a program, modifying answer messages, modifying request messages, and so on. And they do that on purpose. And therefore, in that sense, on the one hand, we can say it does not really happen very often compared with the usage of the system. On the other hand, the consequences might be rather serious, and it also might mean that defense against these malicious attacks are usually very costly. And as you know, with Heartbleed, you have open source, you provide it to the public. The expectation is somebody would possibly quickly identify the error, what's the problem. Well, in that case, it took, I don't know, what was it, 2 years or something, or 1 or 2 years until basically the error was, or the programming bug was detected. And even if it's not an open source software which only a few strange people use, I mean, you have a lot of open source available, and then you possibly have a handful of people using it, there the probability that software errors are detected are then rather low, because not really many people look at it. But that's what I mentioned with the failure model. With certain things we look at it, but here I just want to provide you the type of problems, and then later on we look at solutions to it, at least to some of it. The attacks, that's where we'll look certainly less. That's because that's in a computer security course. And also the secure model, we don't really look at it very much in detail. Only we look at authentication, what was developed with respect to MIT. But the other important thing is secure communication channels with encrypting things and decrypting it on a receiving side, protecting objects with unauthorized access. then certainly you can use access lists, which is maintained by the object. And in the access lists, you have all the processes and applications or users specified who are allowed to do certain things. The other thing is, another approach is here with capabilities. And capabilities are associated with the process, who wants to access an object. And when a process wants to access an object, it basically presents a capability token. And if it's a valid capability token, then the object or the object manager allows access to the object. And it's something similar, a token, you can imagine a key to the door. It's not that you have within the door the access list. You come with your key and open the door to go in. And therefore, in that sense, a capability is always with a process. An access list is always with the object which the process wants to access to. The next things we will especially look at the different software system models in various aspects of it. But first, we will check at transparency. And there are a whole bunch of... I was just thinking how long the course goes. It's until 4 o'clock. The transparency, we can say that's one key enabler of distributed applications. And there are a whole bunch of different types of transparency. And we can just look at the various types of it. Location transparency. An object which might be accessed by a user or by the an application part can be located somewhere in the network. And the accessing user or the accessing application has not really any knowledge where the object is located to, and therefore the name does not contain any information. As a object name does not contain any information about current object location, but host or the object name might contain information of host where object was created, and but it does not mean that the object is still there. It might now be at a completely different site. Why do you have that for the object name? Very often, if you create a new object, you need something like a unique identifier. And very often for a unique identifier, you use the host IP, you use some kind of the time it was created, you use then some kind of a random number, and then you combine that into the identifier for the object. And therefore, in that sense, you have host information in the object name in it, but it's more like on the location where the object was basically created. But here, I mentioned here the printer. You don't really know where it's located. Well, it's and you can access the printer by name, this would allow that you would say, okay, I have a computer here, computer 3, and now I'm, and that also is connected to the network, and now I move the printer to this here. Well, that sounds pretty much a fun for the people printing. And I remember at Xerox in the 80s, they did a lot of experimentation with electronic printing and laser printing and things like that. And one of the things was also accessing the printers by name, and they were not really, the name had not really any relationship with the computer. There you had the situation, and you printed somewhere on a printer, went to the location, and then there was no printer anymore. And it was basically gone. And still, they always had a directory where the currently the printer is located, in which room, on which floor, and so on. But usually, if a printer is located for months and months on the same location, you just go down and then you see, well, bad luck, it's not there anymore, it's away. But by name, you can still access it. Another transparency we already had with NFS with respect to files, that's access transparency. Therefore, in a sense of read, if this one does a read here, I mean here, read D1, and it can also read D2, and this read, the first read is mapped into a local access, the second read is mapped into a remote access, and remote access means the read is mapped into a request message sent to the machine here, and then here mapped into a local read to read D2. And an example for access transparency, that's what we already had with the network file system. And a special type of access transparency might also be something like device transparency, if you access a device instead of a file. But it behaves like access transparency with respect to files or with respect to devices. The an important other part is when you we use replication of files, and here we have multiple copies of the same file. And why would we like to do that? That we can do with respect to performance. We say, well, we want to better performance. You locate all the copies at strategic points in the network that all the people working with the file and the document get a really fast access, or to improve availability. If one file server goes down, then the other file servers with their copies are still up and running. And the point is here that if you have something like an like a read, well, you might access your local file and then do your read. But on this level, you would say only read F. Actually, this user here doesn't know, does it read this or does it read that? If it does a write, if it's a write, you would have a write here and a write here. Therefore, in that sense, if you have a write F, therefore, to keep these copies, or the both copies, up to date in a consistent state, all the write operations must be propagated to all the copies. There exists special algorithms to handle the replication and the update, especially the update of replicated files. And there's, for example, this voting mechanism. And that's what we'll get to know as part of distributed file systems. And to keep all the replicated files in a consistent state. What we can say, the user is unaware that if an object is replicated or not. Therefore, it doesn't know if two replicas of the same file exist. Even you might even have something like a dynamic replication. So here, dynamic replication. And what do I mean with that? If you have something like a user here in the network, user 3, this user starts to use this file F here. But there's a network in between, and now the replication manager finds out, oh, there's a lot of accesses now to this file, and especially to this replica. Therefore, we might have a lot of time delay to transfer the information. Then it might here generate something like here a replica 3 of F, which is much closer to this user here. And therefore, to get better performance, that would also mean if this one does now write operations, all the modifications have to be propagated not just here, they have to be propagated to all the other replicas. Therefore, in that sense, creating a new copy does not just saying copy it and then everything is done. Replica means also more complexity with respect to write operations. It would also mean that if this user 3 is now more or less finished in manipulating and using this replica and this file, the replication manager might delete this replica and say, well, now these two replicas are sufficient. Because with each deletion of a replica, the update problem becomes easier. The more replicas you have, the more complicated it gets. Therefore, in that sense, you also want to reduce your numbers of replicas. The other thing is migration transparency. Well, why would you locate objects like let's say load balancing, you migrate an object from one environment to the other environment, and the correct behavior of the running applications are not really influenced, and it just would mean, well, you update possibly the name directory where the objects are registered with respect where to find them. And if the next time there's a request to the object, then basically it would go to the new location. And that's basically what you do with like host migration. That's exactly what you do with your smartphone and or with your phone, mobile phone. If you move from a cell to the next cell, you just can continue to interact with. Therefore, in that sense, you have something like an online migration, and you have a handover, and then usually the talking partners should not really notice it, then you that you are now handled by a new cell. And the same thing is, you can have host migration like your laptop, and you basically move from one wireless LAN environment to the next one without really any disruption of service. And therefore, in that sense, it's quite a normal thing. Offline migration means you disconnect and then shared data locally available. And and for example, the CUDA file system, we will later get to know, there allows an online situation or a disconnected situation. In the disconnected situation, it tries to hoard the information the user might need in the disconnected operation. And you access your shared data, you change your shared data, and when you get online and connect again, then the underlying system must be able to try to resynchronize the data. It could be the synchronization can be done automatically if there is no conflict, but if there are conflicts, usually then these systems basically give a handover to the involved users, and then the involved users have to decide how to resynchronize their shared data, and because otherwise it's too complicated. The next thing is the language transparency. Well, here you can use multiple programming languages, and they can interact with each other without any knowledge what language you used. And if you take here the calendar system, you would say, well, for the management of the calendar information, I would a C++-based system. For inferencing, I would more use something like an artificial intelligence programming language, because Lisp, or I could also use Prolog. They provide me a lot more with inferencing capabilities. If I use a C system, I would have to program that. In the other case, I get it somewhat automatically with the language, and makes the inferencing a lot easier to program. And on the user interface, I want to use C. And the communication between, well, it's really independent. And you would have just regular interfaces. And if I replace here Lisp with Prolog, then nobody really notices it here. And that's what I mean with language transparency, that there's no dependency. And if you look at .NET, they support language components if they are programmed in C# or if they are programmed in Java. It's basically a transparent behavior. Good. Other ones are quickly located. Failure transparency. Therefore, in that sense, we can tolerate partial failures, like part of or some machines crash, or some networks fail, not all the network, only part of it, and we can mask these failures. And for example, if we have part of a network, we might have a redundant path. And that's the interesting part of the internet, that usually it has redundant path from between sender and receiver. concurrency, transparency, especially if we have shared access to resources which might be used by distributed users or distributed application components, well, they can do that without mutual influence. Well, you can use something like simple locking. There might be some other things what we will later see, operation transformation, and that's a use, for example, in certain collaborative document editors. And what I mean here, collaborative document editors, if you have, let's say, multiple authors, they work on the same document at the same time. You can either do something like locking. You lock a paragraph or you lock a section. And when you lock, you get the right lock to the section, you are allowed to do the modifications. The other authors during that time are only allowed to read it, but they can't really modify it. With operation transformation, it's something like you don't have any locking. Everybody can do changes at the same time, even on the same paragraph. And the underlying system, the collaborative editor, transform operation that at the end comes on each side, the same document is then stored, the same copy. And only in very certain cases there might be a conflict, and if that conflict is detected and then propagated to the authors. In a lot of other things, like if you have here a if that is now a paragraph, and I can usually I can lock that, but now I don't do any locking, I can add here certain things. The other one would add here certain things. Problem is, its positions alone are not sufficient, because by adding certain things, positions are moved. If I use the position from here, then I would normally insert the data here because of the move of the position here. And therefore, in that sense, you do operation transformation that is say, well, the insert is not at position 100, the insert would be at position 140, because here you added 40 characters and therefore everything was moved down. And that's what I mean with operation transformation. It always tries to see, well, what is the start of an operation? Is it the same situation at the original site, or is it a moved, a changed situation? If it's a changed situation, it does an operation transformation. If it's an unchanged situation, then it can just take the operation as it is. Execution transparency, that's very often very often associated with migration transparency, because here you can execute processes independent on what locations you are. And here a very important part are these virtual machines, and you can look at Java virtual machine. Therefore, the intention is you can use your migrate your Java program and move it independently where you are. Well, it's supposed to be, but there are always some slight dependencies. Performance transparency here, while the system is up and running, you can make some dynamic reconfiguration. Also here, while system is up and running, therefore the users don't really know. In the same way, scalability, transparency, you can add new things. And that's exactly what cloud computing does. That, for example, the for certain things, if you reserved this flexibility, that if you get more requests and more requests, then the cloud provider can add more resources for your execution environment, and you don't really have to change the application. It can basically continue up and running, not just now with 10 machines, but also with 20 and 30 machines. And there's no change, and very often you can do that dynamically. And in that sense, you can have something like incremental enhancements or extensions. So here, in incremental extensions. And you don't really have a reboot or something. What you know from Windows, if your software is updated, it asks you, well, now do you want to restart your system? That's not something what you want to have in a distributed environment. Then there might be thousands of people of working with it, and you don't want to tell them, well, now we restart the system because we updated our software. The one thing's goal for distributed, the interesting thing is the original intention was to have as much transparency as possible. And for certain application types, it's actually not desired to have certain types of transparency. And as I just mentioned here, computer-supported cooperative work. That means you have cooperating team members. And the intention is here, you don't really want to have concurrency transparency. Concurrency transparency means, as we defined it, multiple users can access shared resources, and they don't really run into conflict. They don't even notice that other users work with it. In the same way as, like, as you know, with databases, with transactions, that the database system handles all the transactions and serializes them, and you don't even notice it with your transaction operations. Here, the point is, in team members want to have group awareness. And group awareness means they want to know what other people are currently doing, what other people are modifying, on what other people are currently working on. And therefore, in that sense, concurrency transparency blocks it out, that information. We lose that. And therefore, usually with CSCW, you go ahead and say, okay, we have access transparency, we have location transparency, but we don't have concurrency transparency because we want to have group awareness. And the team members, if they know that somebody else is changing that document, well, they have to handle it themselves, if they get in conflict or not. So much for that. The paradigms, I can start a few things. The cooperation can occur on two or with two different types of variants, like in a sense of explicit. And explicit means we have message exchange. We send a message from one process to another process. Here, another variant is implicit. And implicit means the sending process deposits something like a post-it on a board. Then the receiving process later on comes to the board and takes the post-it. Therefore, in that sense, we have an implicit interaction between two cooperating agents. And that's exactly what happens with information sharing. And information sharing is we have something like an integrated information management. We can here deposit information and we can take out information. And it could mean that here this one sends a request. It's deposited here. This one takes the request, handles it, and then it deposits the answer, the response, and then this one takes the response and moves it in again. Therefore, in that sense, it would occasionally look if there's already a post-it for that as an answer to that request. And therefore, in that sense, you have something like a decoupling of these components. They don't really synchronously exchange messages. It's more like, as you have it with post-its, sender and receiver may come at different times. And very often they use it for shared documents, like the BSCW workspace. That's an example of it, which was developed as part of the transfer from the German government from Bonn to Berlin, because originally only part of the government was moving from Berlin to from Bonn to Berlin, and another part was still located in Bonn, and then they used something like shared workspaces to cooperate, and that system was developed as part of it. And here another possibility is sharing objects and sharing components, Java spaces, we will get to know as an example of it. What we need is something like a common data model, which is common for all the involved components. And what we also need is a common understanding of the semantics of the data. And therefore, if, for example, this one stores like geographical data, like position data, which might be used by this component, well, we have to know what type of reference we use, what kind of coordinate systems we use. If we just deposit here the numbers, then this one might use one coordinate system, this one might use another coordinate system, and then we have a complete mismatch. Therefore, in that sense, we need an understanding of the semantics. And access to it, to the integrated information management, we could basically use something like distributed transactions. Or we could use distributed locking as an example to handle concurrent access of it. Okay, the next time we would start with message exchange, and we could stop here because it's time is gone. The point is here.